From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, another big mass shooting, San Bernardino. Uproar in Chicago, climate change and Paris, women in combat, politics over everything. 14 people killed, 21 wounded at a shooting at an office holiday party in San Bernardino, California. First news here before shock and an explosion of questions.
Yeah, several down in the conference, several down.
It was unspeakable, the carnage that we were seeing, the number of people who were injured and unfortunately already dead.
Leaders around the world converged on Paris this week for the United Nations Climate Change Conference. President Obama ready to act.
The United States of America not only recognizes our role in creating this problem, we embrace our responsibility to do something about it.
And the Chicago police chief fired. Now Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel facing growing criticism for his handling of the video recording of a police shooting.
We are not going away, Rahm Emanuel. We do whatever it takes to have this system change from the top to the bottom, and that includes you as well.
From the top to the bottom. This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Susan Davis of NPR News, Michael Crowley of Politico, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What have we just seen in San Bernardino? What do you want to see in response? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington, Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Michael, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Also with us from Washington, Susan Davis, congressional reporter for NPR. Susan, great to have you back as well.
Hey, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Michael, and Susan.
There was the slaughter in the office where Syed had worked, and then the getaway cops eventually on their tail. And here, the shootout on the road. And the two ended up dead there. The SUV rented, shot to pieces. At a press conference on Thursday, here's San Bernardino Police Chief Jared Burgwan. He's a pretty impressive guy, saying he does not think the attack was a spontaneous reaction to something that happened at a holiday party.
There appears to be a degree of planning that went into this. Nobody just gets upset at a party, goes home, and puts together that kind of an elaborate scheme or plan to come back and do that. So there was some planning that went into this.
But it was complicated to figure out. It's still kind of complicated. On Thursday, here was President Obama saying the FBI has taken over the investigation into the San Bernardino shooting.
It is possible that this was terrorist-related, but we don't know. It's also possible that this was workplace-related.
Michael Crowley, piles and piles of ammo, thousands and thousands of rounds here, 12 pipe bombs and material to make more at home, and big questions about whether this is terrorism, whether inspiration comes from within, from without. How do you see this now? Where are we in understanding the motivation for this terrible slaughter?
Well, Tom, we're still working on it. I think that it's pretty hard to believe that this was not a pretty these were not people who were doing anything but preparing for a major attack that had nothing to do with a specific workplace dispute. I think the picture is muddied right now because there appears to there was this holiday party. And one of the shooters was with colleagues, may have had a dispute with one, left and came back. And I think that is creating a sense that maybe this was more in line with workers who have kind of snapped and gone after their colleagues. But when you look at the amount of ammo and explosives they had in their home, leaving their baby with relatives earlier in the day, body armor, all these things, it's pretty clear that they were planning something big. And then you have foreign travel and contacts with people who had been under investigation for potential terrorist activity, although not anyone who was charged. I think the picture starts to become pretty clear, and all we need to do is figure out why it happened to be triggered at that particular moment. Now, coming in the context, obviously, of the recent attack in Paris, and longstanding fears about domestic radicals, I think this is pretty likely to put us back in a place where we are debating once again, what are we going to do about the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, this spreading radicalism throughout the Middle East that is now leaping into our own borders. And how do you fight it? And it's a debate about civil liberties. It's a debate about immigration. It goes to this refugee question, fairly or not, that has been raging on Capitol Hill. So those are the big questions. I think that the details of the attack that have yet to be determined probably won't change that big picture very much.
We should say it was actually not body armor, but tactical gear with lots of pockets for ammo and clips and all the rest.
Thank you.
Not technically body armor. Susan Davis, how is this being perceived in Washington? I mean, the FBI was very careful to say that they have a lot to go through here yet. There's a lot that hasn't come to the fore. The foreign connections are, people have been fast to jump on them. And yes, no doubt, there was a lot of ammo here and a lot of planning here. What category is this being put into in Washington? And is that, whatever it is it fully justified yet? Do we have the clear evidence at this point? Can you say this is ISIS in our midst?
Well, the reactions from Republicans and Democrats have been very different, but also very predictable and fallen in line with previous attacks of this nature, in that Republicans, both the presidential nominees or candidates and as well as Republicans in Congress, have focused more on the question of terrorism, of radicalization, of a domestic terror threat, and what this attack, questions this attack may raise. Democrats, on the other hand, have focused more on the question of gun control and gun laws and whether this is another mass shooting that raises the question of whether and how you can change gun laws in this country to perhaps prevent attacks such as this. So they had a very different, strikingly different reaction. It was, one, a reaction of, is this terrorism and how do we respond to it? And two, Democrats have been less likely or more reluctant to call it terrorism yet because we don't know exactly what the motive was, but have really focused on the access and availability of guns. In this situation, all of the guns that were purchased in this attack were legally purchased, and he had no criminal background record. There's no law that would have prevented him from getting the guns. They were obtained legally. And so we're back once again to having this gun debate in this country, which it's very unlikely that there's going to be any legislative action on gun access. But it is more likely, I think, to spark in Congress, as Michael referred to, the debate over Syrian refugees that's ongoing in Congress, as well as access, foreign traveler access to the country. I mean, that is more where the conversation is right now in Congress.
I mean, Jack, there's so many things that can be true at once here. The fact that these two could go out and buy this huge armament and stuff it in their garage, more or less anybody can do that in this country still these days. If it is Islamic or jihadism jumping the pond and in this country, what a playground when you can just go out and buy anything. And the response is very polarized. Here, let's just get a taste of that, and I'll come to you, Jack. This was Ted Cruz at the Republican Jewish Coalition yesterday saying this is a manifestation of radical Islamic terrorism. No holds barred here.
This horrific murder underscores that we are at a time of war. Whether or not the current administration realizes it or is willing to acknowledge it, our enemies are at war with us.
Time of war, radical Islamic terrorism. There's Ted Cruz yesterday. Here's Hillary Clinton at Southern New Hampshire University saying this should be a motivation for Congress to pass legislation to prevent gun violence.
Just what will it take for Congress to overcome the intimidation of the gun lobby and do something as sensible as making sure people on the terrorist watch list can't buy weapons?
Hillary Clinton yesterday. Jack Beatty, what do you see here at this point? What's justified in terms of a frame for this?
Well, first of all, Senator Cruz was one of all Republican senators, but Mark Kirk of Illinois, to vote against a bill that would have stopped people on the FBI terrorist watch list from buying guns. So he's decrying terrorism. On the other hand, he's voting with the NRA against legislation that would prevent terrorists, potential terrorists, from buying guns. You know, I've just been looking around. There are 40 million more guns than people in this country, and it's clear that Americans are arming up in response to horrors like the San Bernardino, and it's the wrong response. Studies show the more guns in a county, the more gun deaths. A cycle of fatality is playing out. The daily massacre, over 300 this year, prompts people to buy guns, more sold on Black Friday than on any day ever, which increases gun violence and prompts more people to buy more guns. The Los Angeles Times darkly described the cycles tell us, quote, "This nation's infatuation with guns, inflamed by the ludicrous stances of the NRA and abetted by Congress's fear of that powerful group, is suicidal."
Michael, do you have a sense of when we're going to actually get more detail on this, of what role who played here? I mean, you've got a fairly young mother here with a six-month-old child, and father, for that matter. That's weird. A bride who's come out from Saudi Arabia just within the last couple of years. That's unusual. The FBI has collected a lot of digital material from the scene. When might we hear more, understand more concretely what they've learned?
Well, we don't know, unfortunately, and there are a lot of things going on here. Among other things, federal authorities might want to withhold things that they know because, you know, they're trying to do two things here. One is to find out exactly what happened. The other is to find out who else was involved, who else knew about this, who were the associates of these people, do we have other people in the country we have to worry about, and or is there any information in any of their computers or phones, although they smashed some of their devices, that might lead us to someone in the Middle East that we might want to go and kill. So they're working on their own timeline.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, another big mass shooting, this time in San Bernardino. Uproar in Chicago this week. Police action there as well at the center of the controversy. Climate change and Paris, women in combat, all roles open now in the U.S. military. Politics through and over everything this week. Michael Crowley of Politico is with us. Susan Davis of NPR. Our own Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. What are you thinking on San Bernardino? Terror, prayer, gun control? Did you ever think prayer would become controversial? What about the politics of this week on guns, terrorism, doing something? And whether it's war, who looks presidential this week? Steady in a tough hour. Here's a little bit of an interview, NBC News on Thursday, with Farhan Khan, who is married to the sister of the San Bernardino shooting suspect, Syed Farouk, said he did not believe his brother was, certainly not a good Muslim.
I am Muslim. I'm a good person, and there's a lot of good Muslims there. He was a bad person. That was his personal act.
This was a personal act. And Donald Trump, ready to go in all kinds of directions here, saying, yes, radical Islamic terrorism, but also going in a sharp innuendo way after President Obama, talking with the Republican Jewish Coalition yesterday.
When I heard about it, I figured maybe not, but it turns out probably was related. Radical Islamic terrorism. And I'll tell you what, we have a president that refuses to use the term. He refuses to say it. There's something going on with him that we don't know about.
Donald Trump with a kind of throwback to his birtherism there. And really, that kind of language and weird innuendo on the presidential campaign trail, I just don't get it. But let's hear from our listeners. Pritesh, Austin, Texas. Pritesh, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. You know, I think there's two issues here that I'd like to point out. First thing is, as a physician in this country, physicians overwhelmingly support gun reform. And the reason is that we are at the front lines every single day. I think as Americans, we are somehow protected under the bubble of not seeing the real images of what gun violence does to average Americans. We don't see the pictures from Sandy Hook. We don't see the actual bodies. And I think as physicians, we do. We see it every day in our emergency rooms, and that's why we support gun reform. You know, the things that physicians push for, which include a ban on assault weapons, mandatory background checks, closing the gun show loophole, yeah, and safe firearm storage, are overwhelmingly supported by a majority of Americans. Nobody wants to take guns away. We want to make it harder to access for criminals and terrorists.
Pritish, I've got to say that this week it does feel like we're looking at it. I mean, the cameras were not in the conference room where the worst of the slaughter was, grant you that. But, I mean, right on the street, all this triage and sort of like battlefield, you know, sew them up operations almost there, Pritish. It feels to a lot of people like a front row seat. I guess there's a worse view. You get it.
There is definitely a worse view, and the view is not, you know, I think even with this front row seat that we see from our living rooms through the TV screen, it still looks like a Hollywood movie. But when those patients are being reeled into the emergency room and you're sewing them up and
shot
you're
holding
these patients,
yep,
and they're dying in front of you, it changes your entire outlook. And that, trying to find a way to convey that message to the average American that this isn't a Hollywood movie, these are people's daughters and sons and uncles and aunts, That's going to be key to winning this battle in Congress.
Pritish, we've got it. I think it's coming home, but you see more than most of us do, no doubt. Bob in Jamestown, Kentucky. Bob, you're on.
Hi, Tom. You know, every time we have one of these gun incidents, there's always calls for more gun laws, more restrictions. California currently has the strongest gun laws in the country. You can't have any kind of firearm with over a 10-round clip. I mean, a lot of dealers won't even ship guns to California because of the restrictive laws. So, you know, that's not the answer. There's already 200 million guns in the country. I mean, it's not an issue. You can't legislate mental illness.
Hey, Bob, I take your point, and we're going to look at mental illness here next week. But if it's state by state, you can still drive across the border and buy anything you want. They had clips much bigger than 10, is my understanding, Bob, there in San Bernardino.
Yeah. Well, Tom, 30 years ago, I had a conversation the very weekend with Uzi Gow and invented that machine gun after his name. That incident with San Ysidro at the McDonald's. And I asked him, I said, Uzi, do you have anything, any qualms about what? He said, no. He said, that guy could have used an automobile to drive into the crowd there. He said, you cannot legislate mental illness.
Bob, we've got it. I get your perspective. I don't know who's mentally ill and who's not. I do know that they could go out and did, in this country, buy a lot of armaments that they put to very deadly effect. Are there a lot of guns out there? You bet there are. Gloria in Detroit. Gloria, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. My point is that these shootings always occur in gun-free zones, at least most of them do. And I would like to see us being able to protect ourselves in any areas that we choose to venture out to. If people were allowed to protect themselves, maybe we could stop a shooter.
So does that mean you want more guns, Gloria? You wish there had been a shootout in that conference room instead of just a slaughter?
If the shootout would have took out the killer before he killed 20 people, absolutely.
Gloria, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. One more, and I'll bring it to our panel. Peter in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on.
Hi, Tom. My biggest concern from a historic aspect is language and the technology that fuels it. I mean, guns are awash, and we can make a grand show of gathering them all up, but they're everywhere. But language is a real risk. I'm more worried about the harm in hate speech now than I've been in my life studying this sort of
thing. And where are you hearing it most vividly from, Peter?
I am hearing it in all directions. Donald Trump, and I will say it, sounds and reminds me very much of some of the speeches, change a few words around about a bit, of Joseph Goebbels. It is
the propaganda. Nazi propagandist.
It is the danger of harming, destroying the other. We shall wall them off. We'll shoot them. We'll blow them up. We'll do this. We'll do that. And this just triggers everything. Words are weapons. I mean, you know, they can be used to such effect. And there's something about the restraint of freedom. I mean, is freedom of speech really just doing any bloody thing you want to do?
Peter, what about the argument that if you don't name it and call it out, you're not addressing it? That's the Republican response this week, quite clearly.
The problem is, though, that naming a villain, one villain, takes away the responsibility that citizens have in their engagement in this by being entertained by it or staring at their technology looking for the latest thing.
Peter, I think we've got it. I want to take it to my panel. I appreciate your call very much, that perspective. Susan Davis, where do you see this going? Is this what 2016 is going to turn out to be, how we frame this challenge, whether it's all about the other and terrorism and closing borders, or whether there's more at the same time of an examination within? Is that where we're headed, Susan?
You know, it is way too early to say now what the 2016 election is going to turn on. Certainly, if at the current rate that we're at, guns and terrorism certainly seem to be two issues that are at the forefront of voters' minds right now. But we're still a very long way from Election Day. I would like to add to the first caller, the physician. It is worth noting, especially because Congress is expected to vote on this bill next week, for roughly 20 years, Congress has specifically blocked funding for the CDC to fund research on gun violence and gun laws and how they are a public health issue. There's been a specific gag order on the CDC doing any kind of research to that effect, supported both by Republicans in Congress and the NRA, which is something that physician groups in particular have tried to block to get some sort of public health take on gun violence and as a public health issue, and that is specifically not allowed.
And much more. Of course, legislation on mental health coming up next week. Part of the debate here on how you frame this around mental health or around gun access or more than that. One more on this front. Christy in Round Rock, Texas. Christy, you're on.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you see, Christy?
So I just wanted to give my perspective on the mass shooting. I definitely think it's linked to terrorism. I definitely think it's radicalized Islam. It's unfortunate that these people are linking it to their religion, but that's just the fact of the matter. And in terms of gun control, you know, it's interesting because I do believe people should have a right to bear arms and have a gun to protect themselves. But why on earth does anybody need an assault weapon? That's what I find just so puzzling in all of this. It's almost like common sense. Nobody needs an assault weapon, and these should not be accessible. You should not be able to walk into a Walmart or wherever these people are getting these guns from and have access to this. And it would be really interesting to see if somebody in Congress, if somebody in their family was ever hurt or had to deal with a tragedy like this, if this is how they would feel about it.
Christy, we've got it. I mean, at this rate, certainly a lot more people are feeling touched than I can ever recall. Again, this... folks tracking this, shootings of four or more, now 350 plus already this year. That's more than one a day. Michael Crowley, how do you see this spilling over into policy? Is this driving? I mean, this week we had the Defense Secretary Ash Carter saying they're going to send more special forces into Iraq, into Syria to carry out raids, to go after ISIS leadership. Are these related?
Well, I think they are. I'll say quickly that I think we are also going to see an increasing debate, not just about gun control, but about surveillance. I think that's going to come back to the fore. After the Edward Snowden revelations, there was a real backlash against highly intrusive surveillance, and there were some reforms. Not that much was done, but you are going to hear Republicans, I think, pushing hard, particularly in this presidential campaign. Very likely to push the theme that we need to be sort of get over it when it comes to our civil liberties, and that we really need to redouble our monitoring of potential attackers like this. You know, on Syria, look, Paris obviously increased the pressure on the president, a president who was already under pressure to do more to fight ISIS. We're not seeing a lot of results from that campaign. All the administration does insist that they have rolled back ISIS's territory and they are taking out some of their top leaders. But the group is clearly not on the brink of defeat. So this week we heard the Defense Secretary Ash Carter say that we plan to step up our special operations raids to try to take out ISIS leaders. And there really was a track record of this when they kind of got it down to an art under Stan McChrystal in Iraq in the sort of late 00s, late in the Bush administration. They really did a great job of dismantling what was then al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was sort of the predecessor of ISIS. And the theory is, you know, you take out one mid-level leader, you get all his information, he maps you to other guys in his network, and then you go after them the next night, often in these night raids. So the idea is you can step it up and maybe try to do it that way, but it includes risks, the risks of American casualties and the possibility of escalation, sending in more forces. And some people do see the beginning of a slippery slope here.
I want to come back to Donald Trump and language. That's a big deal this week. But on this front, here is Ash Carter on Tuesday before the House Armed Services Committee. And this apparently was added at the last minute. His own staff wasn't clear that this was coming until very late in the game, saying there will be more special forces sent in for these raids in Iraq and into Syria as well, he said, against ISIS.
We're good at intelligence. We're good at mobility. We're good at surprise. We have the long reach that no one else has. And it puts everybody on notice in Syria. You don't know at night who's going to be coming in the window.
Will there be American women in those raids? As of this week, there could be. On Thursday, the Defense Secretary said the Pentagon would open all jobs, combat jobs included, to women if they're qualified. No exceptions.
To succeed in our mission of national defense, we cannot afford to cut ourselves off from half the country's talents and skills. We have to take full advantage of every individual who can meet our standards.
Susan Davis, resistance on these fronts? More special forces in Iraq and Syria? Women in combat? Or is that now in our rearview mirror? We're going for it.
Women in combat?
Both.
Well, I mean, the women in combat thing is really interesting. It's going to open up about 200,000 jobs available to women now. I think one of the facets of that that I heard that I thought was really interesting, when you think about the nature of military engagement right now and where it is in the Middle East, that women in these roles have been particularly helpful because of the gender divisions on the ground, and that female soldiers are able to talk to Muslim women and approach them and build relationships there that male soldiers simply cannot do because of societal reasons, and that soldiers on the ground there have said that it has been incredibly helpful in building relationships, which is something that is perhaps unique to the threat that we face now. It's also certainly that the women in combat are going to have to meet certain physical requirements. This is not they can just do it because they're allowed to do it now. They're still going to be subject to rigorous physical assessment. And Secretary Carter was very candid in saying that a lot of these forces are likely to remain male dominant, but that if a female soldier is able to meet the physical standards required for the job, there's no reason that they shouldn't be able to do it just because they're a woman.
No formal bar they could go, gun in hand. Of course, many guns have been in hand, but not the rank and not the formal combat assignment to go with it. Joy in New London, Connecticut. Joy, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you think?
So I just wanted to comment that I think that the decision of Ash Carter in allowing women in combat roles is potentially more reflective of an increased appreciation and understanding for women and the roles that women can occupy and contribute something, a different perspective, equal capabilities, but potentially different roles and sort of knowledge they can bring to these positions, and that it not only reflects a positive change in the outlook of women in military positions, but also maybe is reflective of this country as a whole becoming more accepting of women in positions that were previously reserved exclusively for men or seen as being exclusively requiring the special types of skills and expertise that men can bring to situations.
I mean, I guess little doubt about that. Kind of a hoo-ah this week, and we'll see what the numbers look like over time. But the formal barrier now down. Jack Beatty, take us to this front, how the country responds, and to our caller Peter's big warning on the language that's out there. I mean, he's prepared to go very hard on Donald Trump for the kind of divisive language that he's using. And then Trump saying there's something about the president we still don't know. What is up? Have you seen anything like this on a presidential stage before, Jack, campaign stage?
Nothing, and his lead is increased in the polls. You know, hungry for ratings, I think the TV anchors have been pretty supine in interviewing him, but that may be changing. This free ride of Trump's in the free media, scarifying editorials in the Times and the Post, have challenged journalists straight out to identify Trump, and I quote a Post headline this week, as, quote, a racist and a liar. Descriptors that are as verifiable for him as a real estate magnate. You know, with one rhetorical question, have you at long last no shame, Senator? Joe Welch disinfected the air of Joe McCarthy. Journalistic honor awaits Donald Trump's Joe Welch.
Michael Crowley, do you see that coming? And do you see an American electorate? I mean, his lead has grown, as he's happy to point out, every time there's trouble, every time there's the word terror in the air.
Well, his lead has grown. I'm not sure that his ceiling has grown that much. In other words, if you look at the number of people who say that they just couldn't contemplate voting for Donald Trump, the math doesn't add up for him, certainly to be elected president. The party could have a problem in its convention if he gets a plurality with so many candidates in the field, and that will be fascinating to watch if it happens.
On Point is sponsored by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses, made in America. They're engineered for comfort and long-lasting support with just the right sink, just the right bounce. Two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together for better nights and brighter days. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. Here's the great part. You can try one risk-free for 100 days with free delivery and returns. Go to Casper.com/onpoint. That's Casper.com/onpoint. And remember to use promo code ONPOINT at checkout to receive a special offer. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, after the birth of their child, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg and his wife Priscilla Chan announced they will give away 99% of their shares in the company that's worth about $45 billion today.
Having this child has made us think about all of the things that should be improved in the world.
Okay, Kobe Bryant calls it quits. The 37-year-old Lakers star is saying goodbye to the NBA in his 20th season.
Finally, I just had to just accept the fact that I don't want to do this anymore, you know, and I'm okay with that.
And Scott Weiland, former frontman for the rock band Stone Temple Pilots, dead at 48, hears Interstate Love Song. Knew it, know it well. We're looking at a week in the news. Another big mass shooting, San Bernardino, uproar in Chicago, climate change in Paris, women in combat, politics over everything. With Susan Davis, congressional reporter for NPR, Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent at Politico, and our own Jack Beatty, you can join us on San Bernardino on The Reaction. And what about police in Chicago? What about the climate change conference and what will actually come out of there? What are you thinking about Mark Zuckerberg's billions and Kobe's retirement? Did you take a break this week and watch The Wiz? A lot of response to things online here. Here, M says, don't want to live in a country where I have to carry a gun to go to the grocery store, movies, etc., because everyone else is. Others prepared to do just that. But Linda in Kentucky says, you ask how listeners feel, she writes. I'm furious with the NRA and the do-nothing congresspeople who suck the NRA teat. Of course the San Bernardino shooting is tied to ISIS, she says. But crazy jihadists aren't the only ones in this country stockpiling weapons to fuel their dreams of hate, our listener writes. They just uncovered the largest stash ever in a South Carolinian's garage. Why does he need thousands of guns piled up? What are his plans? Plenty of questions out there. And then on this race in Chicago, Dame writes to us, look, black people and police need each other to curtail crime. But if they dehumanize us, I take Dame as African-American, repeatedly, how can we ever embrace them? Big questions in Chicago right now. We got to get to climate change, but let's look at Chicago for just a second. Here is Mayor Rahm Emanuel talking with your outfit, Michael, Politico, on Wednesday. Big interview about why he did not get the Laquan McDonald dash cam video out earlier.
Normal pressure would be, if you get to see it, how come we don't get to see it? And we were balancing, as I said yesterday, these two conflicting principles, one being the right of the public and the media to see something, and the integrity of an investigation so it's not compromised.
You hear Rahm Emanuel once writing, hi, Jack Beatty, what is your take? I mean, the police superintendent, they're out this week, and many people saying Rahm Emanuel running to hang on to his own skin here.
Yes, his character doesn't look good in this. He says, well, we held on to this because it would, quote, taint a federal investigation. But on Tuesday, Justice Department officials, to quote the New York Times, said that the Justice Department didn't ask the city to withhold the video because of an investigation. So there goes his backing for that excuse. You know, Thomas Menino, the longtime and now late mayor of Boston, his first year in office, there was a black minister was killed. He was mistaken for a drug dealer, of all things, a 76-year-old minister. The next day, the mayor came on television with the police commissioner and apologized to the black community on behalf of every single Bostonian and vowed that this would not happen again. You know, that character, what we saw with Emmanuel running for re-election, is expediency.
Susan Davis, people are saying, hey, Mayor Emmanuel, did you keep that video under wraps while you were running for re-election? What about the Chicago scene? What you see coming there, Susan?
Oh, it's been so fascinating, particularly because Rahm Emanuel is very well known in Washington. He's a former member of Congress. He also worked for the Clinton administration.
Big time.
And one of the interesting things we saw this week was Hillary Clinton, one of his former bosses, saying that she thought that the DOJ should step up its investigation into Chicago. The mayor initially said he didn't think it was necessary. He's since come around and said, you know, we welcome any investigation. The other thing he said that was interesting, because he's been asked about this, he said he would not resign over this. He said that there is a process for this. It's called elections. He won his election, and that if the voters decide they don't want him there anymore, the voters will decide, and that's the only people that get a decision in this. Chicago mayor, of course, is not term limited. In theory, he could run again, but in the current climate, it's hard to see how Rahm Emanuel is going to be the continuing future mayor of Chicago. He's under a tremendous amount of political pressure, and there is a DOJ investigation. The U.S. Attorney is already looking into what happened in Chicago. There's also a question of whether the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department may take a look at Chicago policing and if there is a broader systemic issue here.
Let's go to Land of Lincoln, Illinois. Cindy in Springfield. You're on the air, Cindy.
Hi, Tom. You know, if you want to look to lack of leadership, you have no further than to look here in Illinois. We're 6 months without a budget. We have a governor that just now spoke, you know, on this issue in Chicago and just kind of shoved it under the rug, you know. It's pathetic. The leadership, the lack of leadership, all of the mistrust is systemic through the entire state. You know, it's not.
What's the problem? Why is this happening, Cindy? I mean,
it has just been allowed to happen. I mean, I think it's just a matter of sheep. We have all just rolled over and let it happen. No one has done anything about anything. You know, I mean, we have a pension system that is never been funded for almost 40 years now. And all of a sudden now it's the problem of the employees.
Yeah, Cindy, we've got it. And fascinating here that the people doing something about it right now are a lot of African Americans in Chicago in the streets on the thing that's touching them most directly, saying, do something about this. That is going to be really something to watch it unfold. A quick stop back in Washington and then Paris. That is big and long-term big. We had Paul Ryan this week, the newly bearded, sort of scruffy, hip-faced Paul Ryan, in his first big political address at the Library of Congress with his vision for the House.
Our number one goal for next year is to put together a complete alternative to the left's agenda.
A complete alternative. And what does the bearded Speaker of the House want from that?
We want America to be confident again. If you don't have a job, we want you to be confident that you can find a job and take it. If you do have a job, we want you to be confident that that job will pay well.
Well, that's all great, but what's on the agenda, Susan, materially? What does that mean he's going to propose?
That's a great question. The speech was big on language, short on specifics. One of the things he did say Republicans are going to do next year is offer a Republican alternative to President Obama's health care law. This is interesting because Republicans in Congress have tried somewhere around 60 times to repeal some or all of the health care law, but they have never put forward what the Republican alternative should look like, and they've certainly never voted on what that Republican alternative should look like. Obviously, if they do bring up a bill and pass it, President Obama is not going to sign this into law, so it is largely a political exercise. And I think there was tremendously strong political undertones to what Paul Ryan did on Thursday. He's clearly trying to lay the groundwork for what a conservative vision for governing looks like, which is supposed to is a companion effort to obviously trying to get Republicans elected to the White House next year. He was the vice presidential nominee in 2012. He is sort of seen as one of the wise men of the Republican Party when it comes to policy ideas. ideas. So I think that he is taking this role very seriously. And in order to win the White House, especially on the issue of health care, which has been so divisive, I think he views that Republicans really need to give voters not just to be a party that opposes everything that President Obama wants, but to be a party that has alternatives. And we haven't seen that on a number of issues. And it's going to be really interesting to see what Republicans come up with on that front.
Overthrow, roll back, new direction, says Paul Ryan. We'll see what that looks like. Paris. We are well into this now. Huge gathering there of world leaders. Each who had their little block of time to speak. And in the streets, not as much as anticipated because of the police presence so heavy after the terrorism there in recent weeks. But some still here with talking with Reuters on Sunday, a climate change activist in Paris explaining why he and many other Parisians took the streets in protest of deterioration of the global climate.
The idea is to show that all citizens of the world are aware, and the common environmental and ecological objective is not individualistic. It's about solidarity, that we are all in the same boat that is planet Earth.
Solidarity, let's do it. We heard President Obama earlier saying the U.S. is ready to take responsibility here and act, and he warned in Paris, wait too long and it's just too late.
I believe, in the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., that there is such a thing as being too late. And when it comes to climate change, that hour is almost upon us.
Rick in Somerville, Massachusetts. Rick, thank you for calling. What do you see?
Yes, I'm a research biologist in the Boston area, and I fear it may be too late. We have people just don't understand that this is going to affect anything from bacteria to mammals, and thus it will affect every human activity on the planet. We have Republicans who deny science in Congress, trying to even now undercut Obama's efforts on climate change. We have talk radio, talk TV, such as Fox News, telling everybody it's a hoax. Just this past week, there was another article in, I believe it was, in Nature or Science, saying that the phytoplankton, which we never think about in the ocean, supplies over half of our oxygen. And current models predict that if the phytoplankton starts to die, that the oxygen level on the surface will start to become closer to what we breathe on Mount Everest.
That sounds pretty lousy. Rick, we've got the list, and we know that it goes on. Whether that's accepted and acted on is amazingly still the issue. Michael Crowley, what do you see coming out of Paris? A road to action here, or are we going to deny to death on this?
Well, I think that Paris demonstrates that the global community is taking this pretty seriously. The Republican Party is a real outlier in the context of the world in terms of its views on the science. In particular, there is in Paris a debate about how do you do this exactly, and you have a familiar divide, among other things, between more developed nations, particularly the United States, and which did a lot of polluting, now have a lot of money and can afford to invest heavily in renewables and ramp down things like coal power, whereas developing countries like India and Brazil are more uncomfortable with all this. They still have a kind of cruder power infrastructure and aren't quite as enthusiastic. So the one of the big goals here will be to try to bridge that gap and in particular come up with funding and sharing of new technology that the more advanced countries can give to the more developing countries that are polluting at a higher rate but feel like it's unfair to tell them just as they're chugging their way up to the top of the hill that they have to downgrade to a cleaner, weaker engine, I guess, to use the metaphor.
And they want a bunch of really cash to flow to help them do that if they even do go down that road. And it is key. India, big key in all this. Their prime minister was there as well, Narendra Modi. Saying, look, you know, there's a lot of us out here who are still with a lot of poor people and they need energy.
A vast section of humanity lives at the edge of poverty and in darkness after the sun sets. They need energy to light up their homes and power their future.
India's leader there, one vote against whatever comes out of this and it all goes down. Jack Beattie, people want the developed world that developed on cheap energy and helped drive the warming that we're apparently in the midst of now, they want them to take responsibility that the president said that they would. But, you know, that's another step beyond just cleaning up the American energy picture. It's also putting up cash to help the rest of the world that hasn't climbed on that train yet.
Not at all. But, you know, in an answer to a question from NPR, Scott Horsley, the president expressed really unwanted optimism that one obstacle to progress, domestic politics, could be surmounted. He thought even a Republican president would follow through on his climate change commitments. Yet, and Rick made this point, while Obama was in Paris, the Republican House joined the Republican Senate in approving bills that undercut the U.S. position there. And, you know, as for Obama's hope that the threat to civilization posed by climate change transcends politics, that finds no support from what the GOP presidential candidates are saying. The Associated Press this week convened a panel of scientists to grade the accuracy of their statements on climate change. The only candidate to score lower than Trump or Carson was Ted Cruz, an increasingly possible nominee.
One more call. Lisa in Lexington, Kentucky. Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've been a political activist for more than 35 years, and I am flabbergasted by the level of hysteria and fear just being fostered in this country where facts and logic have no place in politics anymore. The whole thing with Paris, Jack pointed out that Congress voted to undermine the president. We've got a GOP that undermines the president when he goes to make an Iran deal.
Lisa, you're breaking up on us right there, but we hear that appeal for facts and logic. Can you see Susan Davis, Republican Congress, actually overturning the very things that the President of the United States is promising in Paris?
Well, the interesting question is what they voted on this week, they cannot stop the president. It was an executive order affecting power plant regulations and reducing carbon emissions.
Mm-hmm.
They can't block that. The president obviously would veto that when it gets to his desk. The interesting question is what comes out of Paris? If, for instance, they do come up with a legally binding agreement, the White House has a view that maybe there is a way that this can be enacted without needing Senate approval. Senators, on the other hand, say, look, if it's a treaty, it cannot go into effect without Senate approval. And there is no way the president can get the support he needs in the Senate for his climate change agenda.
And if you get a change in the White House of party next year, promises, well, we heard Paul Ryan there and candidates on the stump saying, roll it all back, turn it all back. What a picture. Susan Davis, congressional reporter for NPR this week. We're very grateful to you for joining us. Thanks for being with us today, Susan.
You're welcome, Tom.
Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. Keep watching. Join us again, Michael. Thank you.
I hope so. Thanks, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Tom.
Hang in there, everybody. What a world. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica, with help from Fatima Tanis and Dave Tarantino. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.